Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the State House Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of December 17th, 2019. I got live taping news for you people right now, so do not skip the intro. I know some of you skip the intro. Don't do it. The Lead will be at the new Craft and Draft in Irmo on January 9th, 2020, people, at 6:30 p.m. That's right, January 9th, 6:30 p.m. We're kicking off the new year with pints, politics, and a preview of the legislative session. Come grab swag, be a part of the live taping, and of course, try your hand at some trivia. January 9th, 6:30 p.m., Craft and Draft in Irmo. A new Craft and Draft, a new year. This week, it is the year in review! Woo! That's right, 2019 is coming to a stumbly little close. Yep, the bars are closing. Get out of here, buddy. You can't stay here. Semi-sonic. That's right, the top stories of 2019, from the legislature to the campaign trail to the horseshoe and Nikki Haley's year of yes, and some more 2019 tidbits. To discuss all that, we have the Post and Courier's Jamie Lovegrove, the state's Mayon Schechter, and the Associated Press's Meg Kennard. It is a wild discussion, guys. Get ready for it. Interact with us on Twitter or Instagram at @SCLeadPod. We always want to hear from you, so holler at us with your thoughts on our social media. Everyone else does, even on bots. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. Make sure you subscribe to us on iTunes, where you can also rate and review us. We're everywhere podcasts exist, including NPR One. And you can listen to all four sections of our podcast while you frantically shop with just days until Christmas. What were you thinking? It's okay. Let the Lead calm you. We're okay. We're here for you. Listen to us while you spend hundreds of dollars you don't have. Or while you wonder who is that madman gluing mini Stetsons onto pigeons in Las Vegas. Is this some sort of guerrilla marketing campaign for Stetson? Who knows? Just stop touching pigeons. Trash birds. That's a whole separate podcast. Now for our brief quorum call. Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present, but here in the South Carolina Lead, we know majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. Number one, the state newspaper reports that the University of South Carolina will not face formal penalties from its accrediting body after the controversial presidential search this summer. The investigation by the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools began investigating USC for allegations of undue influence by Governor Henry McMaster, who pressured board members to vote on Bob Caslon for president. More on that in our discussion. Number two, Beaufort Republican Senator Tom Davis is proposing sweeping changes to the state's magistrate system, this following the investigation by the Post and Courier and ProPublica, this according to the newspaper. His pre-filed bill would bolster the required legal training for magistrates who aren't lawyers, increase protections for criminal defendants who appear before them, and add more scrutiny to magistrate appointments. Check out our December 3rd podcast about this. A lot of people, including my barber, were stunned. Hey, Martha. Number three, Governor Henry McMaster is proposing a $3,000 teacher pay raise for each of the state's roughly 53,000 teachers in his executive budget. State Superintendent of Education Molly Spearman, House Speaker Jay Lucas, and a dozen other House lawmakers flanked him when he made the announcement. The $211 million proposal comes after lawmakers committed $169 million this year to pay for teacher pay raises from 4 to 10%. Number four, Governor Henry McMaster named Representative Bobby Cox to be South Carolina's first Secretary of Veterans Affairs, a position created by a bill the governor signed into law this year. Cox, who won his Greenville seat in 2018, is a combat veteran, Army Ranger, and former congressional liaison to the Pentagon. The appointment is subject to Senate approval. And a special fifth quorum call item. That's because we don't have our campaign trail, and I wanted to get this one in. Sherry Lydon, South Carolina's U.S. attorney, was confirmed earlier this month by the U.S. Senate to become the state's newest federal judge. First Assistant U.S. Attorney Lance Crick is now in line to become acting U.S. attorney until a new appointee is nominated and confirmed. And now for our Florida Man News segment. Every week we give you a headline, a taste of the most captivating Florida Man news. Headline, Florida man tricks out Bentley as police cruiser. And now he faces a felony charge for impersonating an officer. Hashtag 1% problems. What? Whoop whoop! And just like Santa getting stuck in your chimney this year, we buried the lead. It's been another fascinating year of news in South Carolina. So without further ado, let's get into these top stories. From the legislature to the campaign trail to the horseshoe and Nikki Haley's year of yes, and some more 2019 tidbits. We have the Post and Courier's Jamie Lovegrove, the state's Mayon Schechter, and the Associated Press's Meg Kennard in studio. And it is rowdy in here.
Woohoo!
Sounds like a party.
Yes! Year. 2019,
what guys.
A year.
2019.
What a year.
Holy
a
goodness.
Great year.
So great.
The best year.
What's 2020 going to be like?
Oh. Ooh, even better.
Just going to black out for the first few months, I think. But before we get there, we have to look back fondly. And I want to kind of start off with talking about the governor's first full year of his first full term. We saw the governor's inauguration this year. We saw his state of state. He had laid out a lot of big priorities, education being one of them. We saw a lot of education focus this year in the legislature. We saw 10,000 teachers and supporters march on Columbia, something we've never seen before. So a lot happening education focused. And then some other bills that we saw going through. We're talking about the Fatal Heartbeat bill going through the House, ride sharing legislation that changed. We saw a big budget surplus, too. So, Mayon, I want to talk to you, talk a little bit more at the State House, what we saw this session overall, generally, how the governor was treated. It seemed like he got a lot of his things done. We talked about that a lot during this year.
Yeah, I think the theme of the year was people were getting along, which, according to people who have lived and covered Columbia and the State House for a long time, say is a very unusual thing.
Something new and different.
Yeah, right, for the governor, for
the
governor and the legislature to be on friendly terms. Yeah, so actually, I completely forgot that we had an inauguration. so thank you for reminding me.
It was very cool.
I completely live forgot. Hosting that.
I completely forgot.
there was a fly. Over. We were outside.
That's right. That's
it
right. Thank
so
you for
cold.
Bringing me back. I blocked that cold out of my memory. So they started off the year with having $1 billion in new money. So there was a race to spend that. The governor and the House started very early working together to kick out some kind of spending plan that everyone could wrap their arms around. Mm-hmm. And we also started off the year with a new budget chairman, which I think helped some of that work flow a little bit better than before. You brought up education. I mean, that was the big focus of the year with a massive 84-page House education reform bill that slowly made its way through the chamber, but at the end of the day was overwhelmingly passed into the Senate, where it still sits in committee.
And they did a lot of work in the House session. I remember that bill. Poor Shauna, Jamie, your colleague there, she did a whole breakdown of the bill, if you remember going back.
God bless
Shauna for that. And there's still more to come with that. But we did see a big win, at least budget-wise. I don't know if budgetarily is even a word. It's a word? Okay, we got confirmation. Take that, Jeopardy. We got that. But budget-wise, you know, obviously not a big win for the reforms at this point or any changes to education, but they did get teacher pay increases, and that's, again, on the budget for next year, too.
There were pay increases for teachers. There were pay increases for state employees. There was a bonus for certain qualified state employees. There was the rebate. There was more money for corrections, among other things, and I'm sure we're certainly going to see some of that repeated in this next budget year, because the new money is almost double what legislators had at the beginning of the year.
And Jamie, we saw the Panthers tax incentives too, $115 million.
Yeah.
Remember, that was a big push. Two states, one team.
Yes.
Wow. A big win for McMaster there too, among other things.
Ron Rivera will never end up actually seeing that kind of fruition after all the work he did, coming
soon,
down to the
Jamie.
State House.
Too soon.
But Sir Purr will be there,
right,
I'm sure.
Right, of course.
The groundbreaking.
Really, the important player in this whole negotiation.
Weird character.
Was a remarkable debate. Obviously, it gave Dick Harpootlian some of the debate that he likes to have. He likes to be in the center of things. And
spawned investigations.
Certainly was there.
Yeah,
and I think, you did see this sort of issue of the upstate and the Charlotte suburbs and Rock Hill having very different feelings about this than basically everyone else in the state, where there was a little more trepidation about it. But when I went up to Rock Hill after the bill, I think it was the ceremonial signing that Governor McMaster did up there with a lot of the Panthers ownership and a lot of the Rock Hill delegation, the fans up there were incredibly excited. I mean, there were hundreds of people up there just for a bill signing, which you don't see every day. So that was certainly an accomplishment I think the McMaster administration would point to. And I think, going in general to what you were saying about his close relationship with the legislature, mm-hmm. you know, that was an example of something he was able to get out of that relationship. You know, mm-hmm. there may have been governor's pass where when you start taking the fire that Harpootlian was giving, mm-hmm. you know, other legislators might be like, you know what, this is not a hill worth dying on. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to stick up for the governor on this. But I think the goodwill that he had earned helped push it through a little bit. Mm-hmm. He has consistently had a stronger relationship with the House than he has with the Senate. I think it's important to say a lot of debates this year were like 2-1, the House mm-hmm. and the governor versus the Senate. Mm-hmm. And we'll see if that continues. The Senate likes to be a little more they have their own identity,
I think, the deliberative body.
Yeah. And when you're someone who wants to push for results and wants results fast and feel like the public is holding you accountable for it, whether or not that's fair or not, as the governor, you probably want to push things through, and the Senate may make that difficult sometimes.
Yeah, and everything that we've been talking about really got out of the House, I mean, at a pretty good speed and has just been sitting in, for the most part, I mean, with the exception of the Panthers, education.
Right. And even the Panthers took a lot longer in the Senate than it did in the House.
It was like on the last day, right?
Yes.
When they
After
finally
it flew
passed
through
it.
The House.
This was also the first year, let's not forget, where we had a governor and a lieutenant governor operating on the same team from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
And so to have Lieutenant Governor Pam Evatt available to do some of that legwork mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. forge relationships with legislators that perhaps the governor didn't already have. Mm-hmm. I think we've seen that have effect, particularly in terms of economic development, which is her wheelhouse. She's mm-hmm. a businesswoman. And so she comes into this with those strengths and the ability to kind of speak to those issues in a way that we haven't seen before.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
And again, a lot of wins there. So it seemed like it worked out a pretty good year for them, like, as we're saying. So also another bill that's on deck in the Senate right now is going to be that fetal heartbeat abortion bill. That's going to outlaw basically all abortions after 8 weeks. That's when a heartbeat's detected. So that's been debated in the off season in the Senate in some committees, and now it's going to be pretty much ready to go. So that's going to be something we'll be watching and talking about in the future. But I want to switch to our next topic and get you in here, Meg, talking about 2020. We just had our last episode on Senator Kamala Harris's mm-hmm. obituary for the campaign. But it's been a long year. I opened that discussion. We were looking back to January. You were there too with everyone. And the race ramped up from, you know, MLK Day at the Dome. That's when things really start kicking off in January here. We saw people like Bernie Sanders and Cory Booker here. Then Jim Clyburn's fish fry. And then everyone came down for the convention, which is the same weekend as that. And now we're down to 14 Democrats who've got on the ballot. So what was this year in 2020, if you can remember anything? So what's just right in front of
Much
you right now?
Much of it is a huge blur. But, you know, even thinking back to the tail end of 2018, which mm-hmm. is really when the 2020 campaign began in earnest, when we had those senators like Kamala Harris and Cory Booker in particular beginning their trips here, mm-hmm. and then into MLK Day, which really was kind of an unofficial kickoff. At that time, we didn't have a candidate Sanders, we didn't have a candidate Booker, but they were still here. They were still coming to South Carolina, reminding all of their constituencies that they had either forged or hoping to forge, mostly on Senator Booker's part since he hadn't been a candidate previously, but really letting the state know, we're going to be here and we're going to be coming back. And in the weeks that followed that MLK Day at the Dome, mm-hmm. our traditional MLK weekend event here, in the weeks that followed, that's when all these campaigns began to become official. People like Vice President Biden obviously were a little bit later, and there was a long waiting game that we've talked about several times for him to get into the race. But those first weeks in February and March in particular is when the campaigns kicked off officially and then came straight ahead to South Carolina. And so that lead up that you mentioned into the fish fry weekend in mm-hmm. June, into the state convention, we had 24 candidates here. It has whittled down somewhat. Obviously, we all know there's been some fluctuation as the number goes down.
Flashbacks.
I know. I'm sorry.
There's PTSD.
I'm sorry. It has been very, very busy. Mm-hmm. I have lost track of the number of official events that the candidates have had here. I'm sure that mm-hmm. someone has a good tally that we could go look up. But South Carolina has seen probably more than its fair share of campaign activity in this past year. And residents here, all the voters that we go out and talk to, they have had so many opportunities now to really get to know these candidates. Mm-hmm. The introductions, I think it's fair to say by this point, have pretty much been made. Yeah. A lot of voters still aren't paying attention and won't be until the weeks right before we vote at the end of February, or at least until there are votes in other places, maybe like Iowa and New Hampshire. But certainly, the names of all of these candidates have been out here in South Carolina, And we've seen their numbers go up. We've seen their numbers go down. But the campaign has been an incredibly active one this past year. Mm-hmm.
And one thing's been consistent. Joe Biden's been leading
That's
all
right.
those polls in South
right.
Carolina and still has.
He has.
I think we're at 500, by the way, somewhere around
events.
That, according to
Oh, yeah, the Post and Courier event tracker.
Yeah.
See, there you go.
I think
oh
that
ready
I think
resource.
We're somewhere in that ballpark last mm-hmm. time I checked. So.
Smaller field, and we're 11 weeks till primary day. We want to talk really quickly before we get out of this about our former governor and former representative, Mark Sanford, Jamie, who announced and then ended his long shot bid for the president.
Oh, yes.
And maybe we could have got Meg on this, too, because I know she was really right where the iron was hot in the beginning there with this.
So hot.
What was the point of all that?
Just phenomenal question.
Wondering. Inquiring minds. People are like, oh, yeah, Mark Sanford ran for 65 days. Like, what was the gist?
I mean, not to take away from Jamie here, but I think one of the quotes that still stands out to me was from Catherine Templeton, who said, this is Mark being Mark.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'll just leave it there for people to interpret exactly what those
words meant. He knew he wasn't going to win. Obviously, he was saying that beginning, but
you know, obviously, let's first address what he said. His surface, you know, before we dig below that, you know, he wanted to make an issue of the debt and the deficit, and he did try to do that. And he spent all 65 of those days and the 30 to 45 days he spent before it openly contemplating a run, trying to elevate the issue of the debt and deficit. So that was certainly something. He is a former elected official. He had spent some time at the Institute of Politics at UChicago. I think he was probably a little restless and kind of raring to get back in the game. And this was one way to do it.
Yeah.
He had $1 million in his campaign account. He got back on cable news for a little bit there. I think we actually saw him. He was on CNN on Friday. It was funny to see him back there. I don't know if... You know, he expected some contributor contract to come out of this campaign. I haven't seen one been inked yet. But Mark Sanford is someone who feels quite strongly about his political views, his ideological views, wants to talk about them a lot. And a presidential campaign is a platform to do that. I think he was quite open from the moment he got in the race that he knew he wasn't going to win, which I think was why it was kind of odd that he only did it for 65 days, because if you know you're not going to win from the day you get in, why not just kind of just keep doing it until, you know.
You still need money to continue.
You need money to continue, and you need people to be paying. If your point is to be getting a message out there, you need people to be listening to the message. And I think what he realized after about 2 months there was that actually nobody was even listening.
Not much resonance.
At all.
Even after, it came a week after he said he was basically moving his campaign to New Hampshire. And then that was it.
Yeah.
And then also
ended it in New Hampshire.
Yep. The Republican Executive Committee voted not to have a 2020 primary. Mm-hmm. That's still in the courts. We're going to see where that goes. But obviously Mark Sanford won't be on that ballot.
And
either.
I wrote last week, they've now actually passed. You have to tell the Election Commission within 90 days if you want, or before 90 days if you want to have it. So because we are now past the date when other Super Tuesday states will have it, if we end up having one, it seems like it won't be a First and South primary, which kind of loses all the interest in it anyway. So,
just kind of want to stick with you too, Jamie, as we transition to our third topic here, third story of the year that was kind of big was, what about Bob? We're talking about USC's new president, Bob Caslin. He said, you can call me Bob, at the press conference after he was became the 29th president
of the
University of South Carolina. Yeah, transitioning from, you know, General Bob, to just call me Bob. But that came after a long, winding process. He became the president in the summer, you know, with outgoing President Bastides. And he was one of four candidates for the position, but then made some comments about sexual assault that were kind of misconstrued, misinterpreted a little bit, that had led to some protests from students and faculty. And he also doesn't possess a doctorate degree, but he does have a military background, which was an asset for some people. Kind of just tell us a little bit about how this kind of became such a big kerfuffle.
So I was at USC covering the first time the Board of Trustees was expected to vote Caslin to become the president. You know, there were four finalists. I think three of them were white men and one of them was an African-American man, no women. That was one of the things that the protesters had been upset about, was just the finalists themselves and how the process had gone. You know, there was all these protests going on. There were students in the building, in the alumni building, where they were making this vote. And after about 8 hours or so of debating, they finally let everyone in and announced that they were not going to have a vote at all, that they were just going to reopen the search process and start from square one. And that was a very surprising day. Seemed like the protesters had won. They certainly felt like they had won. And we all moved on. You know, a couple weeks later, seemingly kind of out of nowhere, Governor McMaster starts publicly lobbying. Well, actually, kind of, I think, started privately lobbying the members of the Board of Trustees that kind of gets out when some of the members of the board that are not supportive mm-hmm. of Castlin start leaking it and saying, hey, the governor's lobbying us. Then there's now this huge public furor. I think they tried to schedule a board trustees vote for a Friday. Mm-hmm. Turned out that they didn't give people enough notice by law.
Right.
So they
right.
had to reschedule it for another Friday. This was a really chaotic
sort of circus. It kept us busy in the summer, though, you know?
And I think, you know, we were talking about the governor's first full year in office. And this, I was thinking earlier about how he would hate to be compared to Obama in any way, but there was a saying in the Obama administration among a lot of his aides, no drama Obama. We were going to be scandal free. We were going to kind of just focus on legislation and go about our administration that way. And he was very successful in that regard. And I think the governor has done a lot of the same thing, you know, not starting these fights with the legislature, not doing social media warfare, not having any, certainly no personal scandals or anything like that. But when it came to this, all that kind of mentality was thrown out. I mean, he really...
Yeah, because we were talking about the goodwill he had with the lawmakers, and now he's kind of... But at the same time, I mean, this is also kind of something that you have limited responsibilities. You have really limited ability to get much done as a governor. You're just kind of a figurehead. But when you can get something like this through and show this, he can say, hey, look, I did this. I got the support. I think that was something big for
and I don't know if it completely... like ruined his relationship with the legislature. I mean, I haven't seen. I mean, obviously,
I mean, some of them were very, very most Republicans.
Right.
It became what was strange about it was it became kind of partisan, which is odd. I mean, you also had folks who
you had
Republicans
in his...
and Democrats who did not like or did like wasn't entirely partisan, but it kind of became a political battle. Mm-hmm. And that was what I think some of the folks who were opposed to what he was doing, that was the complaint they raised, was that it was getting political influence involved. It even became, as we've seen, sort of an issue with the accreditors who accredit the university and don't want political influence to be.
Let's remember, too, there were emails that came out that would have, you know, drawn that it was becoming a political issue, not just from the critics of Castlin, but from those who were supporting him as well.
I think it also started to prompt a more general questioning of why is this so important? Why is the governor in his first year of his first full term willing to go so hard at this? And I don't think that anything untoward was ever really revealed. The information we got, but there, I mean, I heard from people who were just wondering, what is it about this guy and this whole process?
And he thought that Castlin wasn't treated very proper in the whole process. And then also, he has that military background with Fort Jackson being here. They see that as
a huge
alliance.
Sort of candidate.
Yeah, different candidate, someone unique. Right.
He aligns himself with sort of Castlin's worldview in a lot of ways. And I think, there was this issue of the way that we were treating this former West Point president, who was a high-ranking general. And so I think there was an element of that he wanted to step in on. I think also, University of South Carolina is a massive major state agency. The governor certainly has strong ties to it. His chief of staff, Trey Walker, used to work there. So, I think that people feel very strongly about what happens there, and they do want to have a role in it. You know, obviously, the other funny thing that we haven't quite talked about is that James Smith.
It would be hilarious if we were to go
back to our year in review podcast last year talking about the governor's race. Here we are a year later. James Smith is now a top aide for President Castlin. He openly supported his nomination to become president right towards the end. That was kind of a thing that kind of put him over the edge a little bit and demonstrated some level of bipartisanship there. I think there are probably some questions that remain unanswered from that whole situation.
And and also just kind of wrapping up here, the governor is an ex officio chairman of the board at USC. So that's, there was all that worry about impropriety. He wasn't threatening anyone. He was just lobbying them and trying to get their support. And that's eventually what happened there. But we did see some fallout from this, especially a bill that would reduce the size of the board from 17. You're looking at I think it's the judicial circuits from 17 to 8. So it's the 7 congressional districts with 1 at-large seat. That's a bill that's going to be working through the state house this year.
I think the most interesting part about that is over the past year, there was a growing focus to repair the relationships between the public universities and the legislature. There had been a really frayed relationship for a long time after the recession, after the legislature cut back on a lot of the spending for higher education. And then this sort of just blew up and created this whole new drama that I don't think anyone sort of expected. I think everyone thought, okay, we're on the right road. We're going to, you know, work together more. And then this happened.
Well, I think that actually, the tuition freeze, things like that, those issues, I think, are one of the areas where Governor McMaster and Castlin saw eye to eye with this idea that you were going to focus on cutting costs and not raising tuition. And so that was part of the
reason. And then we do see some of those trustees who are up for re-election are also facing opposition. Mm-hmm. So that's something else to watch in 2020. Switching to our fourth topic, Nikki Haley's year of yes. Get everyone involved in this. It was Haley's first year as a private citizen, and her first act in January was to download Uber. It's always an exciting experience for everyone there. Because she was free from the minute-to-minute, you know, scheduling of her past 8 years.
It's
she was governor. She was U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. I mean, that's just nonstop work. Then she's, you know, news came out that she was going to get speeches, like $200,000 speeches. That was like her full-time job right now. Then she got a spot on Boeing's board making $300,000 or something like that.
Quite a time to be on the Boeing board.
Yeah, really. It's been the year of timing.
And then she has her book out, with all due respect, bought a new house in Kiowa. Meg, tell us year of yes for Nikki Haley.
She has had a very big year. And, you know, this all comes back to politics. And I am not trying to advance the 2024 cycle right now because, please, we haven't gotten through this one. However.
Deep breath.
With all due respect, a lot of these actions that we have seen former Governor Haley take lead toward questions of, well, what comes next? Is it more politics? And some folks who have known her for a long time and observed her say, absolutely, this is definitely something. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about that here several times. But she has taken all of these actions. She is claiming, obviously, publicly that she's focusing on her family. She still has one child in high school who's going to be graduating soon. And she's going to be just enjoying life in her new home down on Kiowa. And I'm sure it's very lovely. However, knowing Nikki Haley and knowing what we have seen her do and the career arc that we've seen her take, I think that we're going to continue to hear people talk about how a lot of this is buildup for a possible run for the presidency on her own behalf. Mm-hmm. There's a long time between now and 2024.
Sure.
As we've all seen, the cycle will start well before 2024. Mm-hmm. But that's still a long period from now for interest in her to be sustained. And so it will be interesting for all of us as observers over the next year to see what her activities continue to be and to see how she tries to maintain that elevated profile.
Mm-hmm. And Jamie, we've seen her become a little bit more of a supporter of the president. You know, when she was up at the UN in New York, she had that distance both, you know, physically being in New York versus D.C. Mm-hmm. and also just focusing on her job. Mm-hmm. And there's an interesting New York Times headline that I just saw the other day. After keeping a careful distance from Trump, Nikki Haley is all in.
Yes.
She had that interview with Savannah Guthrie where she said, in every instance I dealt with him, he was truthful, he listened, and he was great to work with. So we're seeing that shift. And she's also, of course, on her book tour. She's doing these interviews. This is all coming out. She gets a tweet from the president saying, go buy her book. I mean, it's
nice.
Convenient,
nice
too. Yeah.
For the book sales, I'm sure. She has been very supportive of him. You know, as I think I said on this podcast before, as someone who is a sort of strategist in her own right, a sort of observer of politics and of Republican Party politics, it would indicate that she believes that the future of the Republican Party in 2024 and maybe beyond is going to still revolve around Trumpism, whether or not it is Trump himself, and that he has fundamentally shifted the way the party acts. So, you know, the 2016 Nikki Haley that we saw, who was very critical of him and supportive of Rubio, you know, I think she has realized that that is not the future of the Republican Party. She still does, I think, and this is part of the reason why she seems like an obvious 2024 candidate. She does, perhaps better than many others, still kind of bridge the establishment and Trump worlds a little bit. You know, we've seen other candidates, sort of other potential candidates, start to try to do the same thing. So that's going to keep the speculation going. Certainly, a year ago was when, almost exactly a year ago, actually, was when she announced that she was going to be leaving the UN. And I think we already at that point had questions of, wow, okay, it's 2018.
Yeah.
You know, 2024 is six years away. Mm-hmm. Can you keep the attention on you for that amount of time? Certainly, year one is down of those 6 years, and she has succeeded in keeping.
Your
if
best.
Anything, she is honestly more in the headlines now than ever. Obviously, just in the past few days alone, we've seen all this questions about the Confederate flag. You know, one thing I will take away from that, I think, is that obviously in the national persona of Nikki Haley, her role in removing the Confederate flag after the Charleston shooting is a significant bullet point on her resume. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There are increasingly Black Democrats in South Carolina who are trying to undermine that and say that she deserves a lot less credit than she gets.
Senator Merlin Kimson.
Right. And I think that is going to be a theme of her presidential run whenever we see it eventually, is that there are still going to be folks back home in South Carolina, while she remains very popular among Republicans and overall fairly popular in South Carolina, she's going to have some critics, and every presidential candidate deals with home state critics, and they get suddenly a new microphone.
And are we already getting these top criticisms out of the way, you know, ahead of 2024?
Right.
This is like the start, and it's like
she's really going to have to try to find that balance, as I've featured in some of my reporting previously, that balance of the Trump.
Right.
Whatever that looks like in 2024, whether it's him or other people who just embody some of his issues of importance, balancing that between the pragmatic, perhaps more traditional conservative Republican Party from which she came initially, and perhaps where more people would see someone like a Marco Rubio, with whom she was aligned in the beginning of 2016. So it is going to be, it's going to continue to be something to watch to see how Nikki Haley does that balancing act and where that takes her in 2020 and beyond.
So those are some of our top stories. And here are some 2019 tidbits that I kind of compiled looking back over some reporting from the year. Number one, Major General Van McCarty became the first appointed adjutant general by the governor. And on the other hand, the governor recently announced that he would not reappoint Leroy Smith as the head of the Department of Safety. Number two, the SCE&G name disappeared shortly after the completed merger with Dominion Energy this year. And Santee Cooper's future is still up for debate. Number three, Hurricane Dorian. I know Meg remembers this.
Oh, I do indeed.
Hurricane Dorian forced coastal evacuations and lane reversals, but did little damage to the state or anyone's political future.
Allow us to rent some really cool trucks.
I had that sweet F-250 Super Duty.
Thanks, Dodge Ram.
Number four, I know this was everyone's favorite weekend when President Donald Trump was in town for the Benedict College Criminal Justice Forum. Prompted a lot of outrage and from not only the Democratic presidential candidates who were there, but also folks who were protesting there, too. Mm-hmm. And traffic, and there was just a lot behind the scenes stuff that, you know, we're still recovering from.
It was kind of
South
confusing.
South Carolina just doesn't.
Mayan, you were the pool reporter. You were
I was.
You were there.
Yeah.
Right
very
along.
Local pool reporter.
Very, very local pool reporter.
Two people we lost this year of note were Senator Fritz Hollings, who died at 97, and Emily Clyburn, who died at 80. And thank you again to the top journalism from our guests. We highlight these in all of our episodes, which you can find at scetv.org/sclead. Keep up the good work, guys. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you. Week in, week out. It's been a
doing
great
what you're doing.
Year. It has.
Another year down.
Any final words for 2019? Any lookout for 2020?
What's in the crystal ball? I feel like I've thought about 2020 so much in 2019.
that
whatever actually happened that came in and of 2019 itself, I don't know.
Did 2019 exist?
Yeah. Right.
Did 2019 exist?
It's an existential question.
We've used 2020 as a synonym for an election for an entire year.
Right.
And at a certain point, you know, in a few days from now, it's going to be the actual year we're in.
What do we do?
It's going to be surreal.
It's like Y2K when the clocks roll over and everything blows
up. But I think that'll be good for us, right? While everybody else who hasn't been involved in this is going to have maybe
current.
A tough time. And we're just going to like flow right into next year.
I'm ready to type 2020 as the date because that's all I've been talking about.
The ball will drop in New York and we're just going to be like, oh, okay, it's a new year. Okay.
Yes. Well, there are a lot of people in here, a lot of issues to talk about. So we'll keep it fresh. We'll stay on the campaign trail. We'll try and survive the State House and whatever else is thrown at us. Probably another natural disaster because that's just the way things are going.
Why do you have to jinx us like that?
Maybe we won't get it then.
It's too late, guys.
The eye I just got from Meg is just horrible. Thank you, guys. Thank you for joining me, and we'll see you in 2020.
Yay. Thank you. Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure that lawmakers use when speaking to each other. And did you know that South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney is here with some state trivia for us? He is. Russ, happy holidays.
Thank you.
Yuletide greetings.
Yes, glad to be here.
What you got for us?
Let's talk about regions of the state, areas of the state. You know, over time, we've come to identify the PD and the Lowcountry and the upstate and things like that, the Midlands, which was these things kind of evolved over time. The Midlands actually was something the editors of the state newspaper at some point came up with as a way to describe, you know.
Yeah.
And then there are the real areas of the state that the geographers and the geologists would talk about, such as the Piedmont, the coastal plain, even the intercoastal plain and the outer coastal plain. And then there are areas that have kind of worked their way into the vernacular over the years, like the Grand Strand, the Golden Strip in Greenville County, even the valley in Aiken County.
Oh, man. Yeah. We got to go to Aiken soon.
But our question is, where is the dark corner of South Carolina?
A chill goes over the crowd in the studio.
the dark corner of South Carolina. Very real area of the state. Your choices are...
Don't we have a similar question to this recently? It wasn't this one, obviously, but it was something that creeped me out. We'll have to go back and look at it. Something about ghosts, maybe. I can't remember, but continue, Russ. I'm sorry. The dark corner.
Dark corner. A, the northernmost tip of Lancaster County that basically intrudes into North Carolina. Now, that's currently the Indian Land community today, which is a Charlotte suburb. But if you look at the map, that is kind of an unusual area, that tip of Lancaster County. B, the northwestern corner of Oconee County, between Georgia and North Carolina. C, the northeastern corner of Greenville County. D, the county line area, very rural area, between Dillon and Horry counties. The dark corner.
I mean, yeah. Let's hear those again, Russ.
Okay. Northern tip of Lancaster County, northwestern corner of Oconee County, northeastern corner of Greenville County, and the county line area between Dillon and Horry counties. The dark corner.
You know, having worked in the PD, I never heard of the dark corner in Dillon or in Horry. So, I mean, yes, I'm not going to do D. I, for some reason, I'm just thinking mountains and darkness, which makes me think about Greenville a little bit more. I feel like I'm leaning towards C, Russ, for this dark corner.
The northeastern corner of Greenville County is the dark corner.
Woo! Oh!
That's an area pretty much around Glassy Mountain, Hogback Mountain. Mm-hmm. Of course, Glassy Mountain today is kind of has a number of upscale communities that have developed, taking advantage of the vistas and the rolling foothills and the actual mountains there itself. The interesting dark corner was most known for a haven for Confederate war deserters during the war, much similar to like the Cold Mountain book. Mm-hmm. Very similar areas, as a matter of fact, although Cold Mountain occurred around Pisgah Mountain in North Carolina. And then after the Civil War ended, moonshine became a big commodity in the dark corner. Number of distilleries, illegal distilleries, by the way. And then around the turn of the century, around 1900, as more and more textile mills were opening in the Greenville-Spartanburg area, those workers kind of left the dark corner and moved down for those jobs in Greenville and Spartanburg County, which led one wag to write, the jugheads became lint heads.
Which we said were like offensive terms, right? Well, thanks, Russ. I appreciate that trivia.
My pleasure.
Reminder, The Lead will hold its first live taping of 2020 at Craft and Draft in Irmo on January 9th at 6:30 p.m. RSVP at SCETV.org/SCLEAD, and we will see you in the new year. The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on SCETV.org. Listen to the coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV, Fridays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app and SouthCarolinaPublicRadio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts. Search us easily in your Android, the NPR One app, or wherever you find podcasts. Also, be sure to rate and review us on iTunes. It's the Christmas season. Give us a little love. Follow us on Instagram at SCLeadPod, and you can see photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course our dank memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle at SCLEDEPOD. We have swag, sticker swag that is. Send us a direct message on Twitter or Instagram with your address and we'll send one your way.
Email questions, comments, or your gripes to scled@scetv.org. The South Carolina Lead is produced in partartnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier, the State Newspaper, and the Associated Press. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on December 9th and December 12th, 2019. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening.
Secret message. He sees you when you're sleeping. Just think about that.
Oh, I want to be singing.